So the USGA said, hey, can't put a bend in the shaft. So he was like, okay, I'll bore the hole in the grip at an angle. So when I install the grip, we have a bend in the grip. And that was the advent of the pistol grip. And we basically use kind of like AI, right? We mined all of our fittings from the proving grounds, built it into this gapping app. And all you need to do is hit some 7 irons, right? And the app will predict how you will hit all those clubs with really good accuracy without you having to spend the hours like a tour player to go hit them all. Then you can go do like what if questions.
There is a podcast brewing that's about to take over podcasting for good. The only podcast that you are going to need to tune into day in, day out is the Member Guest Podcast.
If I can hit it down the middle of the fairway, that's great. But again, with the driver right now, the driver sucks.
And now, the Member Guest Podcast!
John Daly, and you're listening to the Member Guest Podcast. Rip it, rip it.
All right, Mr. Marty Jurtson from the one and only Ping, my guy. You must have a hand in some of the club design or something going on there, because if you turned a guy like me into like a 3-4 handicap to a +2 in a couple months, I one, not only owe you and everybody at Ping a thank you, but two, I really have to dig into like what the hell is going on over there. So I would love to hear what I saw your background. You played at Colorado School of Mines, which I had a really good friend go there. And so I'd love to hear kind of your story. And I assume now you're full time in Arizona doing what you're doing at Ping. A little background for the audience would be awesome. And then just can't wait to talk about what you guys do.
Yeah, no, Jordan, thanks for having me, man. It's look forward to talking about the engineering magic that we've been doing here. My background, I grew up in like a small mining town just east of Phoenix, a couple hours east of Phoenix. And because it was a mining town, a lot of the executives at the mine, it was a copper mine, had gone to the Colorado School of Mines. And I grew up kind of being a second tier junior golfer. You know, I was always right below all the really good players in the state, the Ches Reeves of the world and Charlie Belgians and all these guys that went on to the tour and win. I was never as good as them. And so I was on the fringe of being like a D1 player or going to you know, get my degree in school. And so I did want to go out of state. Like I had this yearning, like, hey, just get away from home, go just kind of do my thing. So yeah, I just learned about the school, went and visited. We had a friend go there and it was really fun. Engineering school, casual golf team. Now the team is quite competitive and really good.
Yeah.
One of my coworkers at Ping, Jim Canals, went there and was a great tour player, for a good run there. Then just kind of, graduated, got a little bit better junior, senior year, played professionally for, you know, whatever, went to the Q school, chased the mini tour route for about 1 year. And I think in hindsight, I did something very wise compared to a bunch of my friends and saw the writing on the wall, how hard it would be to make it out there. And I quote unquote retired from chasing it right away. And got a job at Ping and just kind of learned the ropes, like used my engineering degree and my passion for the game. And, it's been 20 years since, man. It's been a really fun journey. Love working for the company and just being able to solve a bunch of problems like we've been doing for you.
Hell yeah, man. One of the things that struck me when I was down there, so I did just a little background on kind of how all this got set up. And then my full deal down there was, JD Dunlap, friend of the podcast, member at Winsong, and obviously been with Ping for a very long time, helped set up the, I think it's called like the tour fitting experience down there.
Yep.
So like I kind of told you before we started, it was my first time ever being fit on grass, which like I'm kind of a gearhead. I'm a golf junkie. And I knew that it obviously has a little bit, not even a little bit, it has a lot to do with like how you can see your divot patterns, right? Just like turf interaction compared to...
Yep.
Up here in Minnesota, pretty much all of our fittings are on turf or on mats, so you can't get that feedback. And one of the things that Tyler said that struck me was like, first and foremost, we are a engineering company. We're not a golf company. That's what he said. Like, we're an engineering company, and we just happen to make golf clubs really, really well. And so I wanted to get you as an engineer, wanted to get your kind of thoughts on that and like kind of just how Ping approaches club building and putting like engineering or kind of the, I don't want to say nerd stuff like first, but it kind of is, right? Like it's the nerdy stuff first and foremost.
Yeah, no, it really is. I think people hear that about Ping or hear that about certain companies, but we walk into the office every day and that's like 100% a part of our culture. Is that's our like guiding light, like started with Carson, our founder, John Solheim, John K. Solheim, now Carson's grandson, carry that torch that we want to be committed to bringing like basically physics-based principles. And then engineering, the definition of engineering is like applied physics, you know, it's like practical use of physics for problem solving. Now in golf, that does get hard because humans are very challenging and everyone's so different and have different preferences and things of that nature. That's kind of the very fun part of intersecting. Okay, this works good in theory. Here's an actual human golfer. We need to get these things to weave and line up. And that's what we're on this never-ending journey to do. But the culture at Ping is very much that. Like, hey, we want to do the right thing for the golfer to help them lower their score or maximize their enjoyment of the game. Right. And then we work backwards on the marketing and the storytelling and all that from there. Whereas a lot of other companies, whether it's in the golf industry or another industry, are more the marketing, the story first, and you engineer the product to meet that narrative. We're very much the opposite. And I got to tell you, for engineers, it's a very rewarding place to work because that is the number one priority.
Yeah, 100%. And I saw... So I am a fan and listener of your podcast that you do with Shane every now and again.
Yeah.
And I saw one, I think you guys actually have a title for somebody that's like director of golf science, if I remember right. And you guys were talking about how like in fitting or testing, you know, there's like the robots, right? That can swing fucking perfect every single time.
Yep. Yep.
And then you also have to have the human aspect of it. Right.
Yeah.
And so like for you all, how do you actually differentiate the two? Because I imagine there has to be robot testing, right, with some of it. But then there's also 100%. These thousands and thousands of swings of imperfect humans like we all are that you have to factor into that as well. So like you said, it's never ending. But how do you find the sweet spot?
Yeah. So you're talking about my colleague, Dr. Eric Henderson. This guy is brilliant. And his literally his job title is director of golf science. I mean, he's like curated his dream
title,
job.
By the way. Unbelievable title.
He is a aerospace PhD engineer from ASU who got his degree in like little actuators that land little bots on Mars and things of this nature. So he's literally We have a lot of PhDs that are literal, rocket scientists, I guess you could say. But, you know, if you talk to him, and when we interviewed him on the podcast and he says this, he said, hey, the hardest thing is finding that marriage to the variability, the different preferences, that human beings have. And so in that way, he'll tell you it is kind of harder than rocket science, so to speak. So it's a great question of how you use a robot for when you do human testing, right? So we built our own Pingman robot in-house, like all our own controls, server motors, mechanism design, software. We can test with different moisture conditions. We have like a little mister that'll miss the golf ball, and we use that to test balls and flyers. This is why you're getting a lot of spin on your S159s and on a dewy morning, right? It's because we have that ability to test. And when you want to run that very controlled test, I need the club to be delivered at this angle, this attack angle. With this golf ball, I need to hit it in exactly the right spot. I need to introduce the perfect amount of moisture to get like a repeatable test. The robot is perfect. Like the value of a robot is the robot, let's say we're doing a ball test, can hit 5 shots. And that would take human beings like me, a relatively highly skilled golfer, I would need to hit sometimes 500 or 1,000 shots to get the signal to noise statistically. That's the value of a robot, right? If we're trying to measure the lift and drag coefficient of a golf ball, you can do that in a very short number of shots with a robot. If a human being did it, you'd have to hit hundreds, if not thousands of shots, right? So there's a very important space for a robot for hitting around the face. We want to measure ball speed retention, something like that. Now, when it comes, I think a good example is when it comes to like shaft testing, right? We pretty much threw robots, use our Pigman robot out the window for shaft testing or shaft fitting research, because the golfer is going to apply torque out of plane. You know, imagine a Matt Wolf going in there doing this, or a Sergio, yeah. And then you got another golfer coming over the top. We can't program our robot. We'd have to totally redesign the robot to do all that. So why even try? We can use our 3D motion capture system and pump a lot of golfers through there with all kinds of different quote-unquote loading patterns, how they apply force and torque, when they do it, right? What is the variability of how they do it? Because they would do it a little different every single time. And so that's where we do a lot of player testing. So and then the ultimate product embodiment, whether it's the product or the fitting or the intersection of both, is bringing the knowledge that we gain, the algorithms, the learnings, the insights, and productizing them into a final solution. So at Ping, we do player testing all day long. We have two or three stations going, TrackMan running, weather stations, full downrange, perfect brand new golf balls. And we're running player testing every single day we're open and collecting tons of data. We've been doing that for decades now. Getting those insights from human beings is ultimately, at the end of the day, we're designing clubs for humans. So that's where we need to prove it, you know?
So then for you, like, you know, I imagine you fit, do you fit, you know, quote unquote, the regular golfer as well? Or are you specifically for tour pros?
No, the regular golfer. I think a good way to think about how I try to think about what my role at Ping and what I bring to the table is that the tour player, they get like immaculate service naturally, right? Where in a good way to think about it is the tour player, their club fitting is never ending. It's happening every week. We have the tour truck with the tour. It's like the tour reps are there on the range. Hey, how's it going? Do you need anything tweaked for this week? What happened last week? What are you working on with your coach? You know, are you changing your attack angles? Now we need to look at your driver launch conditions. This is a never ending. It's literally every week, literally. And so what I view my role is to take how that tour player gets serviced, okay, from a fitting standpoint, and make those tools available through our fitters, through software, through other things to the everyday consumer. So that's kind of how I view my role. You know, is I'm kind of very in touch. I've been the tour player a little bit out there. I've developed tools on that end. I know how they're using golf ball. I know how they're finding perfect launch conditions. I know how they're using statistics, working with their coach, working on the biomechanics, and turn that into solutions for the everyday golfer, right? And I think, again, that's in the DNA of Ping, is that Karsten was a frustrated everyday golfer. And he was like, okay, I need to make this game easier for myself. That's still what we're trying to do.
Well, so this is a perfect lead into my next question, which has to do with like how a quote unquote average or everyday golfer builds their bag. Because you and Shane were talking about this on a podcast, like how do you prioritize the clubs in your bag based on how far you hit it? And you know, now that I have a podcast, my friend Andy, who unfortunately couldn't join today, but now that I've got a podcast, I get questions all the time, right, about like fitting and clubs and what have you tested? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? And one of my biggest pet peeves is when I hear pros, like I think Rory is kind of famous for saying it a few months ago, like the cool thing about golf is the average golfer can play the exact same stuff that the pros play if they want to go and buy it. And I'm like, well, yeah, we can buy the same model, but like we don't, to your point, we can't test all the different shafts, like the head weights. We can't dial in like a 9.25 degree loft compared to a 9 degree loft. All that stuff. You understand kind of where I'm going, which leads into the question of, as an everyday golfer who is building a bag to play, right? We're not changing our setups, generally speaking, for different, you know, weather conditions, different courses. Like most people have their bag, they've got it. How do you suggest that people build it? So I heard when you and Shane talk, it's like build it top down with how far you hit your driver, right? Like you may not need a 3-wood if you hit it 290, right? Or if you only hit it 270, you may find that you do need a 3-wood, need to focus on your longer iron. So my question is, you know, for the audience listening and really for myself too, as we build our bags, how do you suggest doing it? Like, what are the main components that you need to take away? Because nowadays you've got crossovers, hybrids, and mini drivers, and low spin technology. Like, you can make five wedges. Like, there's so much stuff, right? So, like, how do we think about this, Marty? Like,
your question is spot on. I think it's a big friction point for consumers. I think it's a big friction point for our fitters out there, right? Like, we make a lot of different options, and options can freeze people. There's like too many options. What do I do? Like, where
17 trillion was the number that I saw.
17 trillion, man.
Right.
So you hit on the perfect problem statement, right? Like, so if I'm an engineer, I'm like, yes, that is a problem, you know? So the question is, well, how do you solve it? Okay. So we can attack this from a lot of different angles, Jordan. So one is, we have a data partnership with Arcos because we have a lot of Ping users using Arcos. Okay. So this is like ShotLink data on tour for the everyday golfer. Again, it comes down to, I know data about tour players. How do I get that to the everyday golfer? So we can mine that data. Okay. So we have data scientists on my team and in our engineering team at Ping. One interesting thing that we've looked at here, we could do a 5-hour podcast on set gapping. It's really a huge topic. But one interesting thing we've looked at here, Jordan, is like, okay, and this is personal to me also. And you mentioned it, hey, if I hit a 290 or more, I might not need a 3-wood. So I was taking some stats on my game of clubs I use on the golf course for where I play most of my golf. Let's say I'm most of the time in Arizona, 90% of the time. Sometimes I'll go to tournaments here and there if I'm fortunate. But here I was saying, hey, I was just kind of noticing this, like, man, I hit 3-wood off the tee a lot. There's a lot of holes that run out at 300 or 290. So I need a 275, 280 shot. I'm like, man, I hit 3-wood off the tee a lot. And I was kind of struggling with it, with some mechanical things going on with my golf swing, right? And so I was like, hey, let me look at that. I'm going to take some numbers on this for my own game. I tracked it over a few months, and I found that 90% of the time or more, I was hitting 3-wood off the tee relative to when I needed it off the ground, second shot to a par 5, right?
So basically it was a second driver for you, is what you're saying? Like, if you hit it totally. 10 times, 9 times, it was because you had to hit a 270-yard shot off the tee, not a 260-yard shot into a par 5.
Yep. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to build, well, we call it Thriver, 3-wood driver. So I built my Thriver, 12-degree G430, 43 inches. Shane's playing one of these. I got a bunch of coworkers doing this. This is a Thriver, right? But the question is,
it's like
a
mini driver now, right?
Well, it's a macro driver. It's not mini. It's 460.
Yeah, it's 460. Okay, so it's a driver, yeah.
It's not a mini driver. That's an insult to the 460. You know what I mean? So it's the Thriver. But it's, you know, and it's phenomenal for me. It's like an anti-anxiety club for me. But the question is that for everybody, right? So we looked at this Arcos data and we said, okay, does this rule apply just for me or does it apply for everybody? We went in there and showed that if you hit it like 300 yards or more off the tee, you will use your 3-wood or your second or longest club you hit in your bag off the tee about 90% of the time. But if you drive it 250, if you drive the ball 250 yards, that's the on average even split where you need half the time off the ground, half the time off the tee. If you drive it 200 yards, if your driving distance is 200 yards, then you use your 3-wood almost exclusively off the ground and never off the tee, right? So it's like, this is where you can't be like, oh, mini driver for everybody, right? It's for the long hitters, right? It's the long hitters need this because they don't need that fairway off the ground into par fives. And this is how we bring in the value of big data, you know, mining that, asking these questions, and then bringing this into the fitting process. Now, the question is, how do you, you know, I think a bigger question is, how do you build the rest of the bag? We've built a phenomenal tool into Ping Copilot. Ping Copilot is a software application, web application that we built for all of our fitters out there to use. And we have an app in there called the Gapping App. And this thing is a gold mine for how to build your golf bag. All you do is you plug in your driver distance and your 7-iron distance. you answer a few other questions about your game, the app will, without you having to go hit a, the question always with gapping is, what's the longest iron I should play? And there's a threshold in there for peak height and land angle and functionality and how well can I hit the 4-iron off the ground or the 5-iron or the 6-iron? Or maybe for some slower swing speed players, the 7-iron or our lady golfers, the 7-iron, right? We make a 7 hybrid. So where should you end that longest iron in the bag? And we've answered that question. We basically use kind of like AI, right? We mined all of our fittings from the proving grounds, built it into this gapping app. And all you need to do is hit some 7-irons, right? And put your launch conditions in, 7-iron ball speed, launch and spin. And the app will predict how you will hit all those clubs with really good accuracy without you having to spend the hours like a tour player to go hit them all. Then you can go do like what if questions. You could be like, oh, what if I played a 7-wood instead of a 5-hybrid, right? And you can see the simulated trajectories. Saves tons of time. And quite frankly, I've heard a lot of people go through these long fittings or book a half day fitting and their bodies can't handle it. Like even a tour player to go do a full bag gapping is kind of taxing on the range, you know?
Yeah, you get tired quick, right? Especially if you're trying to find a sap for your driver and you're hitting 50, 60 driver swings.
Shots.
And you're like, all right, give me some 7-irons. And you're like, man, this thing's going 165, not 180. And you're like, well, probably because he just swung driver for an hour and a half trying to find the right shot.
Yeah. Yes. So it's been phenomenal to our fitters love this gapping app tool because instead of having 6-irons, you know, our fitting clubs are 7-irons, right? So instead of having a 6-iron, 5-iron, 4-iron, you know, a bunch of hybrids, a bunch of high lofted fairway woods, and you having to go out there and hit them, which would take hours to get good data and figure out what's going on, that's how we've built a tool that gives the everyday golfer that service like a tour player, but in a very practical application, right? And so it builds their whole bag. It does, the app automatically figures out your perfect spacing. You can go in there and say, hey, do I want to power spec my loss, which is a calculated strengthening to reduce spin if you spin your irons low. Say, hey, my irons go too low. I don't spin them enough. I want to retrospec them, which is a relaxing of the loss. You can do that. The app will refigure out the perfect gapping into your wedges. You tell the app what your highest lofted wedge you want for greenside play that you're used to. And it figures out all 13 clubs between driver and putter.
Okay, so now I'm going to have to come back down this winter is really what I'm taking away from this, which is both fortunate and unfortunate. The fortunate part is I'm an absolute gearhead when it comes to this stuff. The unfortunate part is I'm going to have to probably end up getting a new set of clubs, or at least some kind of new gapping. And so I'm a frequenter at our local golf store. You guys have one down there now too, Second Swing. Have you heard of those guys?
They do great, man. Yeah. They use our tools wonderfully. Their applied use of Ping Copilot, iPing, our ball fitting solution, man, they do a wonderful job.
They've got the PLD deal down at the Second Swing in Arizona as well. That's where I stumbled upon my first kind of ping putters. I won't talk about the competition at all, but I will say I am officially in a PLD putter. And I kind of wanted to talk a little bit too about, I mean, so we talked a lot about clubs, kind of engineering, but I learned a lot when I went down to Ping, and I will ask you some questions on the vault later because I got to go in there. But I was kind of ashamed of myself that I didn't realize that Tiger played a Ping answer before he ever played on a Scotty Cameron. And so whether it's me being naive or just maybe not, you know, understanding a lot more of the history of golf than maybe I do now, I didn't realize how good of putters you all make in PLD there. And I'd like to pick your brain a little bit on that too. So I'm not going to lie, that big old 30-foot concrete slab that you guys have for the putter testing was super fun. And I was like, I had never even thought of Ping when it comes to putting. And now I obviously do. So can we chat about PLD for a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's fun to look back at old pictures of Tiger, you know, where he's winning U.S. Junior AMs and seeing the I2s and the L8 bag. And I remember, I think it was at TPC Sawgrass when he won on 17, raising the putter with the kind of straw hat on and using the answer.
Oh, that's with the ping putter? That's the answer? Oh, that's a sad sit.
But he still uses our PP58 grip, which, you know,
that's
it's
right.
blacked
with the pig
out.
Man on it, right?
Yep,
yeah,
with
all
the pig
black.
Man on it. And PP stands for ping pistol. And so this is really fun. It was really good golf science story behind that is that Karsten, when he was thinking about the physics of putting, he really wanted like the an offset between the angle of your hands and the center of gravity of the putter, right? He didn't want them all in line. Like his original 1A.
Like a natural forward press, kind of?
Yes, totally. Yes, a natural forward press, right? Because his original putter was the 1A, the one that went ping, and it was center shafted. You know, you could use it right hand, left hand, and center shafted, right? And so he was like, okay, you want it to be kind of more like, you know, like you're pulling something around a corner instead of pushing it. When you push it, it has instability, right? A wheelbarrow or something. You got to like, you know, when you're going to move it, you got to be more steady, yeah. right? So he's like, well, I want to pull this thing, right? So he's thinking about the physics of that. And he was like, well, I'm going to put a bend in the shaft to do it. So his original design and putters or what he was working on at the time is he'd have the shaft go up and instead of putting a bend at the hosel, he put a bend up right underneath the grip. Okay. And that pointed your hands forward, kind of like a natural press, like you were talking about. And it gave the golfer this incredible sensation that they have more stability. Right. And this was the advent of the plumber's neck and offset and the pistol grips. So the USGA said, hey, can't put a bend in the shaft. So he was like,
of course they did.
It was like, okay, when you put a wall in front of an engineer, they get creative, you know, Jordan. So he was like, okay, I'll bore the hole in the grip at an angle. So when I install the grip, we have a bend in the grip. And that was the advent of the pistol grip.
Wow. So I have never heard that. That is unbelievable. So there was a hole in the grip or in the shaft?
Yeah. So what he did is like,
I tried to visualize it.
Instead of the grip boring the hole when you install the grip to be perfectly centered, he did it at an angle. And so now, so the thinner wall up near the top hand and more wall thickness down below. So he angled it. Yeah. So when you installed it, the grip bent.
Gotcha.
The grip bent and formed the pistol shape. And so that was the advent of the PP58, which Tiger still uses today. And the golf science, it's really fun to think about that applied science of why he did that. This isn't just like, you know, chance. He thought about the physics, first principles, and then productized it, brought it to the everyday golfer. And that really changes how the putter feels in your hands. And it can change the delivered face angle. So it's a really good way you can use the how much pistols is in the grip to do that. But we've been doing, yeah, that's what put Ping on the map, man. I mean, that's the name, the Ping putter, the 1A. And it's, yeah. Again, going back to our founder, bringing in really good physics principles to make putting better. We do tons of research. You saw it at the Ping Putting Lab. We have that slab of granite that's like perfectly flat within 1/1000th of an inch for like, you know, over 50 feet. I think it's the longest and flattest piece of granite. Maybe of the world, I don't know. It's even
somebody did
out.
Say that. They said it was in the world. I almost didn't believe them, but now that you're saying
it's even cut out from the foundation. So if we're doing like a very scientific test, looking at the ball roll and a truck drives by or something, or a jet flies over, it doesn't oscillate the entire slab. So there's a lot that went into it, but we do a lot of fitting research and putter design. So PLD stands for Putting Lab Designs. Right. So these are designs inspired by, yours is a perfect example, DS72, our work with Victor Hovland. So we work very close with Victor when he was coming out of college, turning pro, on literally designing a putter hand in hand with him for his preferences, what he wanted to see, how he likes to set up to the ball, his stroke type, which is how much the putter hangs down. There's tons of science to that you want to kind of fit to how much torque you apply about the shaft. So a good way to think about this is if you had a GoPro camera, you know, and you mounted it right down looking down the shaft when you make your putting stroke, how much do you as the golfer torque the face open and closed, right? So twist.
Sure.
How much twisting force, you know, and that's a torque, We call that about the shaft torque. So that's your twisting force open and close. So the more you naturally like to twist the face open and closed, the more toe down of putter you should play. And we have a lot of great research on that. If you think about the history of the game, like let's say a Ben Crenshaw, right? You're like, okay, Ben Crenshaw always played an 8802, very toe down putter. And you look at his stroke, he's like got a lot of face rotation. We have another player on our staff, longtime pin guy, Kevin Sutherland. He actually has like no face rotation. If anything, sometimes he shuts the face slightly on the way back and opens it on the way forward. And he's always played a face balance putter. It makes perfect sense when we look at the golf science of putting.
So on the topic of just putters in general and the actual, the vault, if you will.
Yeah.
My question to you is, what is your favorite thing in the vault? Because I got the whole tour of it and I loved a lot of things, but I have an absolute favorite. And so I want to hear what yours is first.
Oh man, that's a good one. There's so many cool things in there. I mean, I think like, you know, Bubba's gap wedge from the Masters is cool. I think
that's my favorite. That's my favorite.
Really? I love that one.
Oh, dude.
I love that
I've
one.
I've never
dude.
Seen that's... a wedge. I tried to explain it to somebody yeah. and I butchered it. I was like, give me my wedge and I'm gonna try to show you what I mean. And like you're probably better you're gonna be better at this because you know exactly, you know, what it looks like. But the best way I could describe it was like when you have a normal wedge, right? And you're looking down the shaft line and you get yep. a, you know, logo up right on your grip.
Yeah.
His is wide open.
Amazing,
and
man.
And then it's yeah. logo up, right? Yep. And Tyler was like, dude, he's got the best hands in golf. And so yep. like I tried to grab it and like when you grab it, logo up on the grip, the face is literally sitting like flat open like yep. that. And then he manipulates the club head for whatever shot that he wants to hit. That blew my mind. That was unbelievable. Yeah.
It's really cool. So all the putters in the vault, or clubs, not just putters, all the clubs in the vault are built as exact replicas of the specs, not just the head, like we're talking about here. Jordan is like, okay, that's the exact same length, loft, angle, grip, and how he grips it with all the extra tape. You know, and Bubba's phenomenal, man. For those of us that got to see him play and be part of his equipment during his prime, you know, it was really incredible. His like proprioception, his spatial awareness. He could take a backswing and you'll tell him to hit a different shot before he starts his forward swing, and he'll go from a big hook to a slice. You know what I mean? Like imagine, I think the story says is that he grew up as a kid hitting wiffle balls inside his house and slicing around the doorways. You know what I mean? Just imagine that for the
just
creativity.
A shot shaper.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So here's another story about the vault though. We got the Bubba gap wedge. I mean, we got some, I think all the Tiger putters are really cool. Like all the Seve putters, Seve's got the most in there, are really cool. Tom Watson's got a ton of them in there. I love all those. There's a few putters I've personally worked on that are in there that have won majors and other tournaments. Those ones are fun for me personally, is to have a few of my designs in there by other players. But what's fun is one time we had Lee Westwood in, and he's one with the most variety of putters, right? Like he's okay. however many wins he has on the DP World Tour. He's won with, don't quote me on this, but like 50 different models over his career. So we got him all out one time when he was in, and he was like holding them all up. You know what I mean? But we were working on him with him on his putting. He's like, man, I really want to set up like I did when I won the 1997 Abu Dhabi Open. And like, I wish I had that putter. And we're in the lab with him, and we're like, ding, we can go get
yeah,
it.
There you go.
So we literally went and got his gold putter from when he won that tournament, and it was long. It helped him set up more upright on his posture. It helped him uncock, unhinge, or get more dorsiflexion in his left wrist. And these are all the feelings he wanted to work on from a mechanical standpoint. So we went into the vault and grabbed it, and it ended up using that kind of spec to dial in, a current model for him.
Wow. That's 50 different putters winning golf tournaments. Yeah, because when I saw Tiger's, like, you know, there were a whole line of them they're all the same, right? Like they're all the ants or two or whatever they are. 50 different bikes. It sounds like basically me over the last 3 years. He's 50 different models trying to figure out what to use.
He's one with everything, man. Like center shafted, huge mallets, blades. Like he won with the fetch putter, which is named after, I worked on this design. You can put it in the hole and get your golf ball out. You know what I mean? We call it the fetch.
Oh, is that the one with like a circle in the bottom of it?
It's got the circle in the middle. And he won a tournament. You could look this up on YouTube in the Middle East a couple of years ago. And I gave him a little nudge. I was like, hey, man, it'd be cool. I played some practice rounds with him and PGA championships and worked with him a good bit. I was like, hey, if you end up winning a tournament with that fetch, you should get the ball out of the hole with that feature on the final hole after you win the tournament. He did it. He did it on the DP World Tour. Put it in the hole, went in, fetched it out, raised his hands up, got the victory.
I'm gonna have to click that and go find that YouTube video so you can post it. It's pretty sweet.
Oh, yeah, dude. It was really cool.
So that, to kind of wrap up, I want to go through your bag because I will say, so when we started this thing, just like as a little background, you know, we don't do it for monetary reasons. We do it because we love golf and we get to meet and talk with cool people like you. And Shane and Kate Smith. And I mean, we've talked with just a ton of people that we never would have been introduced to if we didn't start the podcast. And a lot of people that followed us early on are just like, they're gear and club junkies, just like we are, you know, like trying different stuff. And so, I was watching your little clip about how you play a 10 and a half, click down to the nine because you like a little more open face, instead of maybe, playing a 9 degree and using a flat setting or whatever. I want to go through your bag real quick and hear kind of what you do in the why, because I imagine this whole thing, if I was just down there, I might have a lot of this stuff kind of fresh in my head. But I think a lot of our listeners would appreciate kind of like going through your bag, what you play in the why. You're obviously a high level golfer as well. So, somebody that we all kind of aspire to be, play better golf. And a lot of it comes down to equipment. So I want to hear what's in it.
Yeah, my perspective is like, you want to have like, golf is all about getting little tiny advantages. You know what I mean? So if you can get a little tiny advantage, your equipment, this is going to give you a major, it's going to add up. You know what I mean? So that's definitely what I do. So yeah, driver, I play the G430 Max 10.5, and I have it in the big minus. I'm pretty sure I'm in the big minus right now. This winter,
that's
I played
what you
in
said
the small
it was.
Minus.
It was big minus, so it was down to 9. So it just opened up.
This is one thing is when it gets hot, the ball flies lower. So sometimes I'll just do a micro adjustment in my loft from winter to summer, but I have in the big minus, RDX blue shaft, and I play my driver. I have the CG shifter in the toe. So that's one of the reasons I played the 430 Max instead of the Max 10K. The 10K. Because you can shift it. And that's like super important to me. I think there's a good custom fitting discussion right here. It's like, okay, why the Max over the 10K? I like a lot of things that kind of take the left side out for me and my mechanics and my game and my psychology and some shortcomings I have in my swing. You know what I mean? So I put the CG shifter in the toe and I play the swing weight relatively heavy, especially because I play my driver a little bit longer, 45 3/4. We'll talk about that.
No, okay.
CG shifter in the toe. And I have the swing weight at like D5.5. So it's kind of like people pick it up as like, oh, it's kind of long and kind of heavy. That's kind of how I set up my driver right now. And because it's a 10.5 in the big minus, it takes the loft, like the big minus takes the loft down 1.5 degrees. So it plays like a 9 from a launch condition standpoint.
Why the longer shaft? Like just more distance or just a more
A tool in our pink cobalt to help you answer this question is like, what's better from a strokes gain standpoint? We've done this really cool stats that show that for like distance is more important than accuracy at a ratio for better players of 2-1, right? So for me and you, our skill level, for every we could gain 2 yards of distance and live with 1 more yard of offline from a strokes gain standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right? And we actually have a tool in Pink Copilot that lets you analyze this if you do get on a launch monitor and do it. If you're a common golfer, 10 to 18 handicap or plus, that ratio is way more important for distance. So this, like, I think one of the biggest misperceptions out there for better players is that tour players play short drivers. They do not. Let me tell you this. I know all the specs, man. We have so many tour players playing 46-inch drivers. Victor Hovland, Joaquin Niemann, a ton of others. They play their driver at 45¾ to 46 inches. Why? It's because they know that modern-day stats and analytics show that distance is more important than accuracy to a certain point, right? And then our driver's so forgiving. The other big misconception in fitting is that, like, you need to get your impact stat area tight, super tight. I would not use that as your number one goal in a driver fitting. You know what I mean? Because our drivers are so forgiving nowadays that it's okay to have a little bit of impact variability and within reason. Obviously, like, yeah. Of course, yeah. There's obvious exceptions. You got to put that disclaimer on everything. But so that's why I play my driver a little bit longer. And then I have a thriver. So if I need to hit a tee shot, if I need to hit a tee shot 285 or 290 with my thriver, I can do it. You know, I can hit a hard draw and do it if
so,
I need
so
to.
So you have a 10-5 turned down to a 9, and then you have the exact same model head, just at a 12-5 with a shorter shaft?
Yeah, I have our G 430 Max 12 degree, and then I play our Tour 2.0 75 Black, which is a super stiff shaft, tight torque, really stiff and bending stiffness. Play that relatively heavy too, CG shifter in the toe. Now I play that with the trajectory tuning sleeve, our sleeve in the flat position. So I take it 3 degrees flatter from our standard position. And a lot of our competitors, for some reason,
you are anti-left, man. You're really anti-left. Yeah,
well, you want to do that when you play it kind of short. And I hit off the tee a lot and things of that nature. You know what I mean? So it's it works out good. I change left to right trajectory with those clubs with my tee height. So if I need to draw that thriver, I just tee it up higher. Most of the time I tee it super low and kind of hit like a chippy straight ball or chippy little cut, just super easy off the tee. So that's how I handle the top end of my bag. And then I have a couple options to bridge the gap between that club and my Blueprint S 4-iron. I'll play an I-530 4-iron. Which the loft is like 19 degrees. It plays kind of like a crossover.
I was going to say, so that's not the crossover. That's a different model.
No, I play the I-530. It fits in to my eye and the offset and the sizing a little bit better with the Blueprint S for me. So I play that with our tour shaft. So it's our crossover shaft. It's built like exact specs of a crossover. And I play that if I'm going to hit a lot of these kind of, and I hit that club 250, so it's a 4-iron, but it really plays like a 2-iron, you know, 2.5-iron or something like that. And so that's my like 250 club ish. And then I play that if I don't need to hit like a lot of shots high into a green. And this is very easy to determine before you play a tournament. So it's not like I carry 1,000 clubs; I carry 15, and that's I've switched between a 5-wood and that club depending on the course, wind, and conditions. Super easy as a good golfer to figure out what clubs you're going to need on the golf course. I'm actually really surprised people don't spend a little more effort into this, and hopefully we'll build some tools to help people with this problem in the future. It's like, okay, what clubs am I going to need for this course? Very easy to figure out. I've played tournaments where I'll take out a 5-iron. I literally know I will never have a 5-iron. Like it's just impossible for this course to yield the 5-iron. I'll put another wedge in. I'll carry 4-iron and 5-wood. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we're going to Ireland, and I'm leaving my 7-wood behind, and I'm bringing my 3 crossover and sack.
Absolutely.
The second I need a 7-wood, it's going to spin 5 times. The ball's going to start coming backwards at me, right? So I'm not bringing the 3 iron. And do you go Blueprint S through the irons, or do you have some tees
in
there too?
I go Blueprint S. I play the Blueprint T pitching wedge. Love it, man.
Okay.
I just love that little smaller size. It's great, dude. And then S159, 50 degree. And then I play a 56. This is a little interesting. So I play the 56 wide sole, or W, bent to 55. Yes. And so I tend to get a little steep on my wedges. I need to work on that. But I love having the extra bounce. Like, it's super wide, a lot of camber. Now, I do bend it to 55 for both gapping and to reduce the bounce angle by 1 degree. And so... And then also, if I have a course with very powdery bunkers, I'll just be like, man, I got a wide sole. It's a really good idea for folks to consider playing a different bouncing grind in their sand wedge than their lob wedge, both for full swing, but also bunker and short game shots. So I play a very high bounce sand wedge. I'm not saying everyone needs to do this, but I like this. Very high bounce sand wedge and then a low bounce lob wedge, right? So I have very different options for short game shots.
I think that's what I'd, so my 60 is a 6T.
So T, I think that, yeah, T grind, yeah, low bounce, thin sole.
T grind, and then the 54 is like, I want to say it, 12S. Does that sound right?
Yes, the S. Yeah, so yeah, you get a little bit of difference setup between those two. Yep, totally. And then I play the H grind, which is our half moon, new half moon grind, the S159. And I put a, we're doing this on the tour with a bunch of our tour players. Harris English is one of them. I put a dish grind in the middle, which is our I2. So it takes the middle section of the sole. We put a little scoop in it, like the I2 wedges. And it takes all the camber out. So if I lean the handle, it plays like super low bounce, sharp lead edge. I can get it to stick. Like if you're playing a grainy lie and you need to get steep on it and kind of recoil a shot, you can do it. And then if you lay the handle back, you still have a lot of bounce. You can play off the trailing edge. So it gives you this little like more versatility in handle lean. And it's really awesome out of the bunker when you put that little dish grind in there. So that's been enormous for me. I'm loving my lob wedge setup. I play my lob wedge short. It's a half inch short, 34 and a half inches. I play it light swing weight, so like D1. And that helps me reduce the ball speed. It reduces the momentum of the club being delivered. It makes it a little finicky for full shots. Like if you play,
I was going to say, you're not going to be able to feel that head as much at the top for full shots though, right?
You got to be a little careful on the full shots. So it's like, oh, okay, I'll take a few extra practice swings, get my low point dialed in. Because if you go too light, a good player will just get too steep and they'll lose some low point control. But it's worth it for me for the gain on the on short game and chipping, have that ball come off the face softer.
You're probably not using that on full shots very, very often. Something really specific.
Exactly.
And then so, what are we rolling?
Man, I switch putters all the time. I actually think it's a good idea to switch putters all the time. There's some good research on this, but I switch between arm lock. I've been putting arm lock lately with a catch.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I switch between that and a long putter, a PLD Oslo. PLD Oslo, which is a beautiful mallet design. Yes, awesome. Yeah. So We make that in a long putter. So I've been a broomstick putter for like 20 years off and on, but I'd say 95% of the time. And I switch between arm lock catch and Oslo long right now. And I play good with both. It's kind of more just how I'm feeling, or if I get a little cold with one, I just switch to the other.
Yeah. But there's a lot of the best players in our club. You look in their lockers, they've got like four or five putters in there, and like, you know, something's not working. You put it in timeout for a little bit and either find out real quick if you don't know what you got until it's gone, or if it's time to make a change. So I get it.
It's a good idea. There's an academic researcher down here at Arizona State named Debbie Cruz. She's done a lot of work with the ASU golf team, a lot of really good like neuroscience studies with golfers. She's helped a lot of golfers cure the yips through some different techniques. She did some great academic research that validated that when you get cold, you should absolutely switch putter. So I'm a fan of that.
gotta look at something different. It's probably always fun to find something new in the bag. You get a new putter cover or whatever. So
yeah, and I think that from a scientific standpoint is that you apply different forces and torques to the putter, right? And so it's almost
naturally,
like this
brain
refresh that you get.
Yeah, for sure. Well, here's what I can tell you. Next time I come down there, the way that we're talking right now, it's not going to be a half day fitting. It might end up being like a long cleaning because out over this stuff all day.
So
I appreciate you taking some time, man. This is really awesome, truly.
Yeah, Jordan, it's been fun, dude. And here's the other thing I do in my golf game that anyone out there can do. So this is not like some trade secret thing. I found out last year that my local section where I play all my tournaments, and then USGA locals, I got on the tee last year, and they're like, "Yeah, the one ball rule is not in effect." I was like, "Huh? Like when did this start?" And so I switch between right now, I've done up to five golf balls. I've won some section tournaments where I've literally played five golf balls, but I switch between three golf balls during a round. I think every golfer should do this. If you're like a high handicap golfer, at a minimum, play a ball that's optimized to go straighter and longer on par fours and par fives, and play a ball that spins more, flies higher, and lands steeper on par threes. At a minimum, play a par three ball. But if you're a better player, if you want to have an equipment advantage, I did this at the PGA National Championship, dude. I mean, I've done it in huge tournaments. Just won our local section match play where I'm playing three different balls. I play it into the wind ball.
Is that local for you guys, or is that everywhere?
You ask your local tournament association, but our local the PGA of America does not adopt the one ball rule, and then USGA locals. So ask your whatever local tournament you're playing in, just ask them if the one ball rule is in effect. And if it's not, it's very wise to play different golf balls for different conditions or different wind conditions and things of that nature.
Oh, now I have to ask real quick, what do you play? You put Titleist guy, or what do you play ball-wise? To know, Ping's agnostic to balls.
Yeah. We have a great ball-fitting site that my team built called ballfitting.com. So we know a lot about how balls fly and wind and things of that nature. But I play the Pro V1 Left Dot is my main default ball.
That's and the new one, right? Isn't that between the X and the regular?
Is that between the regular and the what dash? That's the dash. The dash flies very medium. The X goes very high. The V1 goes low. The V1, that left dot, which is a ball that's about 6-7 years old now, flies low like the V1, but with more greenside spin like the X. So it gives you this like interesting combination. So that's my default ball. And then I'll play the 8. If it's super windy, I'll play the AVX into the wind. Or I'll play, and if it's downwind, I switch to the V1X or the Bridgestone Tour BXS if it's super firm and I really need to spin a wedge shot. So we got a lot of options in there.
I wish Andy was here to hear that right now, because he would be the first person to swing and buy five different sets of balls and start implementing that, man. You're talking about stuff that not even I had thought about. Like, I never even thought about playing different balls. Different condition. I got fit into the Pro V1. It was like 97%, he said. So I just playing bad. Bought a bunch of Pro V1s right now. So,
yep, perfect. Yeah, no, that's good. But, it depends on how deep the rabbit hole you want to go down.
Dude, we're so far down the rabbit hole right now. I'm never coming out. So I appreciate you taking some time on a Tuesday morning. I would love, if you're ever up in Minnesota, we need to see Jamie Dunlap again. We live pretty close to each other, very close to our club at Windsong Farm that your friend Shane just helped with the redesign of the logo here.
Yeah, that logo's sick.
Would love to host you guys if you're ever in town. It would be an honor. Hopefully we'll see you next time.
Oh, man. Jordan, I'd love to. I'm going to see Jamie D here shortly, one of my favorite people in the golf industry. And GUR Designs, they crushed on that logo.
Dude, they did. They did a great job. And they're doing Wyzetta down the street. I know they're starting to do like Golf Buddies trips logos. I think we're thinking about maybe an alternate, like something for the podcast. Just a little something to put on apparel, or who knows. They got some awesome ideas. So they crushed it. You're clearly out there crushing it. Appreciate your time, and hopefully get to meet you in person soon.
Jordan, that was awesome, brother. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Marty. Yeah, have a great rest of your day.